Good evening. My name's Al, and I'm a grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. Has anybody here never been to an Al-Anon meeting before? Can I see a raise of hands? Well, welcome. Welcome. I hope I can give you a little taste of what this fellowship has freely given to me. I think I kind of want to start out. One of my favorite poets that I found is a 16th century Persian poet. And I tell this to people all the time now. You are the sunshine. Everything else is just the weather. So what I'm going to give you today is a little bit of my weather report. Of the storm I grew up in, the bomb that landed in my life, and the total sunshine my life is today. And it's sunshine because of you. I was born September 30th, 1956, in Portland, Oregon, at Emmanuel Hospital, and I'm sure that's when I had my first resentment. That frickin' doctor had the balls to hit me. And it just seemed like life went downhill from there. It was always confusing. And I just did not understand what the confusion was. One of my first memories, I think I was 4 or 5 years old, and I have four sisters and a brother, and we were all sleeping in the living room on this big fold-out couch, head, toe, head, toe, head, toe, head, toe. And I remember waking up in the middle of the night, and my parents were fighting in the next room. I heard this body-to-body hit, and I saw my mom fly across the room, crash into the coffee table, and sit there in fear. And I remember jumping up out of bed at 4 years old, saying to myself, I'm going to put a stop to this shit. And as I jumped up, one of my sisters grabbed my arm and pulled me back down into bed. She just said, shh, be quiet. And from that point on, I was always quiet. I just sat and watched. I remember the night my mom got up and she ran into the kitchen. And my dad opened up the front door because the bird cage was knocked over and the bird was out, and he was shooing the bird out the front door. And then I remember him yelling, look what you've done, you dumb bee. You've let the bird out. And then my mom come out of the kitchen with a gun, and my dad took off running. The story is she did shoot him in the finger as he was driving off. And the next thing I remember was the cops showed up. And I love this cop because at that young age, I heard him say something that I would use for years. He said, Mrs. Shaw, we have to have the gun. We can give you one chance, but we're not supposed to give you a second. And I thought that was so funny and so sarcastic. And so that's the kind of language I learned how to use. I learned how to use sarcasm. And but my main language was four-letter words. And that's how, what I learned to use growing up in that alcoholic home. I remember a couple of years later, I was about six, and I came home from school, happy, content. And my oldest sister said, go stand in the corner and wait for Dad to get home. What do I have to stand in the corner for? I didn't do nothing. My dad came home, and he walked over, and I remember he hit me so hard, I lost all bodily functions. And at that point, I was not afraid of my dad anymore. I hated him. I remember thinking to myself, one of these days, I'm going to grow up, and I'm going to inflict that same pain onto you that I see you inflict onto this household. And then also, I scanned the room, and I was looking for all my brothers and sisters, because I know somebody ratted me out, and I don't know which one it was, but you're all going to pay for it. So I became very resentful and angry and frustrated at a young age. And as time went on, the disease just grew bigger and more powerful. It just seemed like there was always arguing, yelling, and screaming. And I remember as a young kid, I would take my favorite blanket and my pillow, and I would go into my closet and hide, and I'd put that pillow over my head, and I would talk to myself until the screaming stopped. And then I knew it was okay to come out. But I had that conversation going on in my head at a very young age. And I knew for a fact that I was unwanted, unloved, and alone. I can remember another time my dad would take me out on the weekends to go get a haircut a lot. And he would drive up to 28th and Ankeny, and there was a tavern there called the Purple Goose. And right down the street, there was a bar called Holman's. And I didn't see which one he went in, because he would park about a half a block down the street. And as he was getting out of the car, he'd turn around and look at me, and he said, whatever you do, I don't want to see you leave this car. And if you do, I'll kill you. And I knew he was serious. So I would sit there for hours and watch the world go by while I was stuck there in this disease of alcoholism, trying to figure out what the hell is wrong with me. What is wrong with me? My dad would come out of the bar, he'd get in the driver's seat, he'd pick me up, and he'd put me between his legs, and he would say, I'll run the gas and the brakes, you drive. And I was in total paranoia. We've got so far to go. You know, I didn't realize we're only 12 blocks down the street. You know, I never thought of that. I just thought we were in a foreign land. And I didn't understand what was going on. And finally, a couple years later, I came home from school. I was about 7 years old. And my mom said, pick up the furniture. We're carrying it down the street. We're moving to a new house. I didn't know Dad wasn't coming with us. I didn't know they were going through a divorce. Nothing was ever said. Nothing was ever said about anything in our house. You just did not talk about anything. And we moved to this different place, and then it was time to go visit Dad. My sisters never went to visit my dad. My brother would come sometime, but it always seemed like it was me that had to go visit Dad. And I would go over there, and I'd watch him get drunk. I didn't understand. I didn't understand the disease. I didn't understand what was going on with him. But I lived in fear because I knew if I said anything or did anything, there's a good chance I would not come home alive, that he would kill me. Because he was very violent and very angry all the time. And that kind of continued on for a few more years until I think I was about 9 years old, and me and my brother were over visiting my dad. He went out and he got drunk and he came home, and he couldn't even drive us home that day. He called a taxi cab, and the taxi cab come got us, and they took us home. And my mom didn't even have money to pay for the taxi cab. You know, she was a single mom with six kids. She was a waitress and a cook. She was always working at a double shift just to keep a roof over our head and food in our bellies. And I didn't understand why she was gone all the time either. But I remember her, when we got home, she picked up that phone and she called my dad and she said, "You're never going to see these kids again. That's it. I'm done with this." And about a month later, my dad shows up at the house one day with a rifle, and he's going to kill us all. And that was pretty much of a common thing for him. He would bring stuff home. He would bring swords home. He would threaten to chop our hands off. He would just do this scary stuff that we just always huddled in fear. And I remember wanting to know what was going on downstairs with my dad and my mom, but my sister wouldn't let us come around the corner to see what was happening. And I guess what happened is my dad kind of passed out. My mom grabbed the rifle, and she ran out of the house down the street and called the police. And they come caught my dad, and at 9 years old, that was the last time I saw him. But I still had this anger in me. And what had happened in that house is we all learned this alcoholic dance, this disease you do when you grow up in an alcoholic home. And so my dad was gone. My mom was working all the time. So it was just us six kids. And we did exactly what we saw our parents do, fight. And that's what we did. We fought, we yelled, we cussed, we threw fits. I think one of the most ingenious things I ever did is, you know, you have six kids and you all want control over that TV so you can watch your show. So I learned to pull all the knobs off the TV, and I had the pliers. I had control what was going to go on in that house that day because I had the pliers. And that would start another fight amongst us. Because that's all we knew how to do was fight. And be angry with each other and be resentful with each other and be bitter. And that's mainly how I spent all my youth. And I can remember when I'd be walking down the street, and if I saw a car go by with a guy with a crew cut and glasses, I thought it was my dad. And I thought he was coming to finish us off. So I learned how to walk back alleys. I learned every backyard in the neighborhood. I could run through any black backyard in the neighborhood. Nobody could ever catch me because I knew what fence to jump over. I knew where the vicious dogs were. I knew if I jumped over that fence, the dog would come running and I'd jump right over the next fence. So whoever was after me would get over that fence when the dog got there. So I learned how to escape everything. I learned how to escape my feelings. I just learned how to escape. I'll say I used to go to school, and school seemed like a safe place for me. But I didn't learn anything. Because what I did, I would sit there all day and daydream. But my mind kept wandering. And I would always think, what's going to happen when I get home? Who's going to be there? What kind of chaos is going to happen today? Luckily, when I was 15, got the call, my dad died. He had finally drank himself to death. He died of hardening of the arteries, cirrhosis of the liver. A painful, lonely death. And I remember going to his funeral and seeing him there. I thought he was going to jump right out of the casket. You know, it seemed so real. And the one thing I thought was, I don't have to be angry anymore. I don't have to live in fear anymore. I don't know anything else. So I became nothing. I was the wallpaper. I'm not there. I just tried to disappear from everything and everybody. And I lived that way for most of my life, being afraid of people and not wanting to be involved with anybody. I'll say it, at about 19, I was in college and I found alcohol myself. And I'll say, alcohol was not my problem. It was my solution. So I drank alcoholically for the next 10 years because I just did not know how to do life. All I knew is that I felt unwanted, unloved, and alone, and I couldn't stand to be me. When I was 29, a miracle happened to me. I met a girl, and I liked her. She had sex with me. She told me she loved me. I'm like, wow. And so I'm at a company Christmas party on December 24th, drinking myself under the table, and she came to get me to give me a ride home. And at that company, we got $100 bonus, 1985. And I remember I got in the car and I looked at her and I pulled that $100 bill out of my pocket and I handed it to her and I said, Merry Christmas. We can either go to the store and you can buy yourself a coat for Christmas, or we can go to Reno and get married. My face hit the window, I slumped down, and I was gone. About 9 hours later, somebody's shaking me, waking me up, saying, where do we get gas? And I'm like, what do you mean, where do we get gas? We're on the outskirts of Reno. And I'm thinking, this is a solution to all my problems. I remember when I was a kid, the best time I ever had was Sunday at 6 o'clock watching The Wonderful World of Disney. Everybody's life sucked. Then something would happen and they would live happily ever after. Well, my life sucked. Something's happening now. God, I'm gonna live happily ever after. So we decided to get married on Christmas Day of 1985. And we go home, we set up our little house, we have a good time for a couple weeks. Her stepdaughter comes over. I have a stepchild now too. I have a ready-made family. Woohoo! And it's great for a couple weeks. Her stepdaughter goes home. She goes right back to doing what she's done every day. She grew up in an alcoholic home too. She was an alcoholic too. And that's the life she wanted. She wanted to live the alcoholic life. Something in me just couldn't go back. I could not go back there. I wanted this family life so bad, I would do anything to get it. And it wasn't happening. She would take off and go get drunk, pick up some guy and disappear for a week. And I would sit there in misery at home. What did I do wrong? It's got to be something with me. I'm unwanted. I'm unloved. And here I sit alone, all by myself in bad company. About 5 months of this, going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, she gives me a call one day and says, I'm checking myself into a treatment center. And I'm thinking, good for you. You need to get your shit together and everything will be okay. And so she's off at this treatment center, and a couple days later, I get this letter in the mail from the treatment center. Well, what the hell do they want? So I open up this letter, and it says, I need to abstain from all mind-altering chemicals myself. And attend 2 Al-Anon meetings. I read that letter, and I tore it up, and I threw it in the garbage can. What the hell do they know? They can't see into my life. They don't know what's going on with me. But I thought back, and I remember at about 10 years old, I was reading the newspaper, and I read this Ann Landers thing. 20 questions. Did you grow up in an alcoholic home? Yes, 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 yes. No, no. Wow. You know, at 10 years old, I hadn't been fired from a job yet because of alcoholism. And I haven't been divorced yet because of alcoholism. So I don't belong. It didn't matter that I had all the other ones right. It just did not matter. I missed two. That's good enough for me. I'm not going to go any deeper into this. And so I'm thinking about this letter I got from the treatment center, and I want to go down to the family day on Saturday, the next Saturday, to visit my wife. So I guess I'll try an out-on meeting. And I do what I usually do. I roll into some place rather early. I park my car, and I sit there. And I watch these cast of characters walk in there. And I'm like, what do I have any common thing in my life with them? But something told me to walk into the building. So I walked into the building. I saw there was a literature rack. So I don't want anybody to know I'm there. So I grab a piece of literature and I go sit down and I open it up like I'm reading it. Maybe nobody will notice I'm here. I have this piece of literature that said, Understanding Ourselves and Alcoholism. And I had opened it up to a little thing that said, Help and Hope. Many of us walk into these doors feeling unwanted, unloved, and alone. Unable to believe in the possibility of change, and unable to go on as we had before. As I was reading that, for the first time in my life at age 29, I started to cry. Then the meeting starts. And they say, Welcome. I cry harder. I didn't feel like I was welcome anywhere or wanted anywhere. And as the meeting went on, I heard people talk about growing up in an alcoholic home, being married to an alcoholic, having kids that were alcoholic. And it was so overwhelming that these people are talking about things I don't even have the words for. And I almost felt that I was sitting there and somebody had peeled all the skin off me and all I had was nerves. Everything you said hurt. I just hurt. And so I'm starting to get in touch with my feelings now, which is very uncomfortable because I've stuffed them in this little box all my life. And that was on a Sunday. Monday, I went to another meeting. It's right on the corner from my house, three blocks. And it's the same thing all over again. Different people, but the same feelings. The same confusion, the same hurt, all over again. And then the next Thursday, I went to my first AA meeting. And I remember being in that meeting and sitting down, and this guy on this side of me looks at me and he says, Look where your best thinking's got you. I don't like that. I'm going to look this way. And this gal on this side of me looks at me and she says, hold on to your ass. You're in for a ride. Wow, what a ride. So I got 3 meetings in, so I'm going down to family day. I know she's going to have everything all together. I've certainly got things together now. And I go down there, and she won't even talk to me. Ignored me completely. Some of the guys there that were in treatment took me aside and started to read me things. Page 449 out of the big book, that's edition 3, about acceptance. I didn't understand any of it. And I was just afraid, but I was unable to tell anybody how much fear I felt at that moment. And then we went into the family day where there's a couple hundred people in the room and everybody's in there all together, family, patients, everybody. And of course, it starts out with me. The counselor, nutcase, her name was Barbara. I knew she was nuts. She asked my wife, you need to tell Al something. She looked at me and she says, I don't love you and I don't want to be married to you anymore. Goes right back to those core issues. I'm unwanted. I'm unloved, and I'm alone. But now, she said it out loud. All these other people know that. And I'm panicked. But I'm sitting there, calm as a cucumber. And this nutcase counselor named Barbara has the nerve to ask me the stupidest question anybody had ever asked me in my life. Al, how did that make you feel? I know how to talk about feelings because I learned it well growing up in that alcoholic home. I just looked at her and I said, F you. Then I relaxed. It was seconds, but it seemed like hours to me. I just relaxed because I know she's going to leave me alone now. Well, Al, that's not a feeling. Let's try again. It's like my whole inside exploded, but I don't know what to do with it. So I said, I feel like shit. And I calmed down again. Hi, Al. That's not a feeling either. Let's try again. And by that time, when I get nervous, my right leg shakes. And I think it was shaking so hard, it looked like I had to go to the bathroom. And I just looked at her and I said, K, Can I have that piece of paper on the wall over there that has feelings written on it, and I can choose a few of them? Because right now, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be alive. I don't want nothing to do with life. I can't handle this. So that started me on a journey, because what they told me before I left there that day was, you better find a meeting on the way home. And I remember finding a meeting on the way home, and I remember walking in there, and I just sat there and cried uncontrollably for the whole meeting. And that's kind of how my story began in the Fellowship of Al-Anon. I would go to meetings, and I'd sit there and cry. Somehow I was able to talk through the tears, but it just seemed so emotionally, it was like an emotional upheaval in my life, that it wasn't just the alcoholic marriage I was in, but it was the alcoholic life I had lived in for every day. And I didn't know there was a different way to do it. I thought that was normal. And so I'd go to these meetings and I would cry and I would talk. And I do remember it was 6 months. And I probably went to 5 or 6 meetings a week. And I'm in this meeting that was my home group at the time, the Cabana group on 145th and Powell. And I remember I talked through the whole meeting and I didn't cry. Everybody in the meeting stood up and applauded me. Then I started crying. I never thought I was worthy enough. To get what you had for me. To gather these things up. You know, they told me when I got here to not make any major decisions for the first year. And I'm like, oh, there's some things that need to happen in my life. But I'll start to listen to you. You know, when I got here, they told me, go to meetings, go to meetings, go to meetings. When your ass falls off, pick it up and take it to another meeting. What really scared me is when my first sponsor told me, practice your recovery like you practice your disease. I remember looking at him, I said, well, where do I bring my sleeping bag? I need to be here for 23 hours and let me out in the real world for an hour and I can try it. But this is the only place I feel that I belong right now. It's the only place I can talk about my fears, about my faults, because I had nothing good. And I really believe that there was nothing good in my life until I will say, when she checked out of treatment, I checked in. I was so distraught with life and the abundance of choices there was, I did not know what to do. I did not know how to exist. I did not know I could put one foot in front of the other and walk. I just wanted to turn around and run. You know, it was that fear thing. Fuck everything and run. And that's what I did all my life. I ran, I ran, I ran, I ran, I ran. I did not know how to stay here and do a relationship. And as my marriage kept on falling apart, I was able to stay there and watch. I didn't have to be a participant in all the chaos, I could sit there and watch. I'll say one thing that helped me was step one was I remember I started to get lofty expectations. So I'm on my way home from work one night, and I know she's going to be home when I get there. I just know it. So the more I know it, the faster I'm driving, and I finally get home, and I walk in the door, and it's empty. She's just out doing what alcoholics do. I didn't understand that. And I had such high expectations before I walked into that door. And when I walked into that door, boom, I was flat on the ground. And I remember as I was scanning the front room, I saw this spoon in the ashtray. So that gives me a new direction. Instead of thinking about what I'm mad about, that gives me something else to be mad at. What the hell is a spoon I eat off doing in the ashtray? So I pick this spoon up, and I'm going to throw it across the front room. And I start to throw it, and I hear this voice, this Al-Anon voice says, changed attitudes can aid in recovery. So I stopped. I didn't throw the spoon. Well, it was a wooden-handled spoon, and the metal part flew out of the handle across the room, right through a glass lamp, and the lamp and the lampshade are crashing to the ground, and I'm sitting there holding this piece of wood going, goddamn Al-Anon. I can't even get pissed off right today. I can't do nothing right. And then for me, at that next moment, I did something very uncharacteristic. I picked up that 15,000-pound phone, and I called somebody. And I talked to him about what my expectations were, what I did. Here's where I'm at. And he talked to me. He calmed me down. He told me expectations are just premeditated resentments. I had an expectation. I walked into the door. I immediately had a resentment. And that started a journey for me where I was able to start to dive in to this program and start to dive into these steps a little bit more. The God thing was very hard because I remember growing up in that home, all I heard my dad say was, God damn it, God damn it, God damn it. So growing up, I was pretty sure God had a last name and it was damn it. And so to come to the realization that he doesn't have a last name, he's somebody I need to come in contact with. I don't know how to do it. I start listening at meetings a little more deeply. And I remember a guy saying, here's what I want you to do. When you get home at night, I want you to take your shoes off and stuff them under the middle of the bed. You'll be on your knees. You can say hi. And it started off where I was saying, hi, asshole. Look at this. Look what you got me into now. Because it gave me somebody to blame everything on. Blame, blame, blame. You know, if you take me out of blame, 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 what do you have left? Blah, blah, blah. And I was full of blah, blah, blah. But it gave me a starting point to where I could start to talk to a power greater than myself. I didn't understand it. I didn't know what to do with it. But there was changes happening to me. And I remember one night I was laying at home in bed, all alone, in just a terrible space. And I was laying face down in the pillow, which I never do. And I remember asking God, please help me. Please help me. I felt so sad and so depressed. And as I was laying there, I felt these hands touch the back of my head and my hair and start to press my hair down. Next second later, I remember, I'm the only one here. What's going on? And I remember I jumped up out of bed, spun around, and I'm looking, who's here? I remember I turned every light on. I looked in every closet, every bedroom, every nook and cranny. I took a flashlight outside, and I looked around the yards, and I'm like, somebody was here. I know somebody was here. Wow. And it kind of showed me that there was a next step I needed to take. Because, you know, they say step one, you know, I did not cause her to drink. I could not control her drinking, nor could I cure it. But I was pretty sure I caused everything all my life. Everything was always my fault. My fault. It's my fault it rained today. It's my fault that something happened somewhere. And I always took all that pain on until I could start to sort through this stuff. And, you know, I just kind of danced around it. Step one, two, three. Step one, two, three. Step one, two, three. I did that waltz, one, two, three waltz. And then I finally got ready to do my four step. And I remember doing my four step. And I remember my sponsor telling me, write down what bothers you. Just write down what bothers you. And there was a couple big things and a lot of little things that bothered me at the time, and I wrote them all down. And I remember talking to him about it, and he says, okay, I want you to go home tonight, and I want you to write 10 good things about yourself, and I'll see you tomorrow. And I remember looking at 10 good things tomorrow? You got to be kidding me. But I faked it, made something up, and it started me on a journey to where I could start to work these steps and start to implement them in my life and see how I was changing. You know, after that first year was up, I got rid of her and I just concentrated on me. Take care of me, take care of me, take care of me. One thing I will share before I end, you know, when we're new, we don't think we can help anybody. I certainly didn't think so. My life was so screwed up. But I remember getting off work one day and a guy that worked at a business down the street comes walking up to me and he says, Al, I was told to talk to you. Okay. He says, I'm an alcoholic. And I think I'm going to kill myself. What do I do with that? I've got 90 days in the program. What do I do with that? But what I started doing was carrying an extra big book of Alcoholics Anonymous underneath the front seat of my car. And I said, Dave, wait right here. And I walked over and I grabbed a big book. I had a schedule for AA. And I gave it to him. I put it in his hands. And I says, I don't know what's going on with me, but I know something is changing in my life. And then I reached in my pocket and I had that 90-day chip and I stuck it in his hand. I said, take this. Try this program for 90 days. And if it doesn't work, go ahead and blow your brains out. Didn't see him again. 28 years later, I'm out driving in the wilderness in Hodgkin, Washington, and I see there's an AA Al-Anon meeting, so I thought, well, I'll go in there. And I'm standing in the room, looking at the bulletin board, seeing what activities are going on, and here walks in Dave. Dave, you're not dead. And we sat down and we started talking. His sponsor was there. His sponsor had 29 years. I had 28 years. Dave had 27 years. Dave shared with me. He said, you remember that 90-day chip you gave me? I said, yeah. He says, I still have it sitting on my dresser. It's the power of what you guys can do for another. We as a group have more power than me just by myself. I don't know how to get out of my own way. But when I come here and I'm around you, God works in my life. You know, God used to be a group of drunks. Now God is good, orderly direction. And as long as I try to work these steps to the best of my ability, the better my life gets. And today I can be the sunshine. Thank you.